1 Corinthians 10:1 through 10:12, the 26th talk in a series on 1 Corinthians, was presented by Ron Julian on August 10, 2003 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2003. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Okay, we're continuing on in the book of 1 Corinthians this morning. We're in chapter 10 now. Let me just tell you briefly where we have been so far. This section starts in chapter 8 of 1 Corinthians, I think. 8, 9, and 10 form a unit of Paul's thought. And so far what we've seen is basically this. There is an argument going on in Corinth about whether a Christian can eat meat sacrificed to idols, of which there was a lot around in Corinth. One group is insistent that they have the right to eat the meat. There's nothing wrong with eating that meat. And they may also be as well going to the pagan temples and eating in the dining rooms there. There's some debate about what the background is here. It's possible that they're taking the liberty of doing that as well. Paul has responded to them, to their question. What do you think, Paul? How should we handle this stuff? By arguing like this. He said, on the one hand, I agree with you that you have the freedom to eat the meat because there is only one God and there are no real idols, so there's nothing wrong with this meat, it's just meat. On the other hand, in your situation, you should not exercise that freedom because you are putting pressure on immature believers to join you in doing what they believe to be wrong. You have put them in a situation where you are subtly and not so subtly putting pressure on them, insisting that they join you in this freedom, which they do not see as a freedom. And thus you're encouraging them to do what they would see as wrong. Paul says, let me use an example from my own life, the way I use my freedom. I am an apostle, in spite of what some of you Corinthians think of me, and I have the freedom to be financially supported by you. The Lord himself, in fact, has told us to do it that way. There's something right about the workman receiving the wage for his work. And yet, I have not exercised that freedom with you, and I did that for your sake. I didn't want my taking money from you to get in the way of you hearing the gospel that I was proclaiming. And so I worked to support myself instead of sitting back and letting you support me, because I wanted the gospel to be heard by you unencumbered. That's the way I conducted myself. And let me tell you, I did it for my own sake as well, because it is important for me that I not just preach the gospel, but that I believe the gospel that I'm preaching. And how could I claim to believe that the gospel is true and that the citizenship in the kingdom of God is the most important thing that a person could attain in this life, and yet think that it's more important for me to get money than it is for you to hear the gospel unencumbered? Here was an opportunity where the way I used my freedom was actually a reflection of whether the gospel really meant something to me, whether I really believed it or not. So, Paul has been saying to them that Christian freedoms are not absolute. The theoretical right to do something can be overshadowed by several other issues. First of all, love for my brother. If I am doing something that is going to provide a stumbling block for my brother, and I've tried to be very clear what that stumbling block idea is. This is not just a blanket sort of, I should never do anything that offends anyone, but there's something very specific that Paul has in mind. It would be unloving for me to be that stumbling block. But equally important, and maybe even more important, ultimately, I have to remember that the way I live my life is a reflection of what I believe. And the Corinthians, when they encounter that question, am I going to exercise my freedom or think about its impact on the other person, they are encountering the question personally themselves, where the rubber meets the road. Do I believe this? Do I really think that the gospel is the valuable and life-giving giving thing that I say it is? Or is what's more important to me that I get some meat when I want it? So their own salvation, their own investment in the gospel ultimately is being worked out as they're assessing these questions. Now, as we go into chapter 10 then, it is the second point that I have to live my life in a way that I am living out the faith that I say that I have, that I actually have to believe, personally invest my own life in the truth of the gospel. That's the theme that is going to prevail. For a little while here, he's not going to talk so much about the idea of being the stumbling block or, you know, not the weaker brother. He's focusing in on this question. Look, there is a race to be run. Some people make it and some people don't, and you want to be one of those who make it. That's what he ended up talking about at the end of chapter 9, and now he's expanding on that theme. So, in order to make it clear, I hope it will make it clear what's going on, I have a couple of things that I want to say before I actually talk about the text itself that I hope will help fill out, will help you to see what I think is at stake here. First, an analogy to the situation that Paul is talking about. And you'll see why I'm doing this analogy in a second. But let's imagine that I am a person who feels that I have a Christian freedom to see R-rated movies, at least some R-rated movies. And I am involved with another person who feels that it would be morally wrong for a Christian to see R-rated movies. In fact, they're quite convinced that it would be disobedient, immoral, rebellion against God to do such a thing. Okay, I think this other person is out to lunch. I want to watch R-rated movies, and more, I want to create an environment where my perception of this prevails. So I put pressure on this other person. I treat them as kind of naive. I portray myself as being the one who is knowledgeable and sophisticated, and they're the ones who are ignorant and not understanding the true freedoms we have in Christ. And I subtly sort of create this environment where if you want my approval, if you want to be one of those people that is in with me, you're going to have to join me in this. Because while you have this hang-up about R-rated movies, you're just not with it. You're just not the sort of person that I like to hang around with. Okay, so here we have a situation. One person says we have freedom, the other says we don't, and the one who has the freedom is putting this pressure on the other person to join them. Now, what are the roots of that sense of freedom that I have, that I can go and see R-rated movies? In this particular example that I'm giving, it is true that I, if I were to articulate my philosophy, my theology, I could make a case that, yes, I have the freedom to see R-rated movies. I believe in that freedom. I'm not lying about that. I genuinely think that's true. And let's suppose for the sake of argument that it is true. I'm not here to make an argument on that one way or another. But let's just suppose for the sake of argument that that is a true Christian freedom. And I understand that it is that freedom. Even deeper, though, it's not just the knowledge that I have the freedom, but I, as a person, I like the thrill of doing edgy, provocative stuff. In fact, little people don't know this, but I, the person in this example, actually find myself sometimes using pornography and involving myself in all sorts of actually sensually gratifying things that I don't have any question in my mind are wrong. I know they're wrong, but this is the way I want to live. I want to indulge myself in the way that I want to indulge myself. So this person who is putting the pressure on someone else to join me in this freedom that we have, it's not just about freedom to me. There is actually something that I want. I want the world to be the kind of place where you can go to R-rated movies because I want the thrill that I get there. I want to be able to indulge myself the way I want to indulge myself. So I'm glad that my theology would say that there is a freedom for me to do this thing because it's in fact what I want to do. In fact, I want it so much that even when it's wrong, I still want it because I'm going to indulge myself in this way. Okay, now I hope my example is clear because it's important to understand all of the different things that are involved in this picture. The choice that I am confronting then about how I exercise my freedoms in this regard is a complex one. First of all, there is the issue of the violence that I am doing to you. I am putting pressure on this person who thinks it's wrong to join me in this. So I'm disregarding the impact of my actions on them. It is unloving of me to put that pressure on them to join me in this. But not only is it unloving towards them, it is unfaithful on my part. I am ignoring the reality of the importance of the gospel. When I put that pressure on them to join me, it's as if the freedom to watch R-rated movies is more important than obeying God and submitting to the dictates of your conscience so that you might find life from the God that you are looking to. That's ultimately, if it's more important to me that I get you to go along with me, then my own personal values, my own sense of priority, what is important, is all out of kilter. I have put sensual gratification over the importance of the gospel in my own life and in your life. But finally, there's this third element as well, which is basically, it is out-and-out rebellion on my part, because it's not just about freedom, it's that I want to gratify myself whether it's right or not. So you see the levels involved here. The issue is, what impact am I having on you? What does that say about me and my faith? But finally, it even transcends the issue of whether I have freedom to do it or not, and it is also testing me on the question of whether I am actually willing to submit to what God would say. What if there were no freedom? What would I do with that? What do I do in that area where there is no freedom? Why am I setting up the example this way? Well, I think that all of this, that scenario that I have described, is analogous to what we have going on in Corinth. On one level, the issue is about freedom. Yes, you Corinthians have the freedom to eat meat sacrificed to idols. God thinks that's okay to do. But no, you cannot put pressure on your weaker brothers to violate their conscience. It is unloving to them to do that, and it is unbelieving and unfaithful of you to put eating meat over the importance of the gospel in their life and your life. But the issue goes even beyond the question of freedom, because for the Corinthians, some of them are emphasizing their freedom to eat meat sacrificed to idols because, in fact, they are soft on idolatry. It's not just that there is freedom to eat meat sacrificed to idols, but actually it is not a big deal to them that idolatry is involved with this, and perhaps they even like the thrill of being involved with it a little bit. They may actually find it comforting to be involved with the idolatry that they were involved in before they were believers. They may think that it's very hip and sophisticated to be a Christian and yet have the boldness to be involved with eating meat at the temple and stuff like that. So, not only do they have freedoms, but they are exploiting the idea that they have freedoms to indulge themselves in things that they really shouldn't be indulging themselves in. I think that is the fullness of the picture that we have here. So this section is not just about freedom, although it is. It is in part about what do you do with things that I genuinely have the right to do, but may be disruptive or destructive to other people. But it is also ultimately about the question, am I going to submit to the reality that God is there and that He is calling me to one thing and not another? Am I going to dabble in idolatry or whatever it might be because ultimately I don't take God seriously? Or am I going to draw the line and say, no, that's not for me because God is for me? That is part of the issue in this section. Now, In order to make clear then why that's significant, I'm still not going to talk about the text. I have one more thing I want to say. I want to talk for a minute about idolatry, so that as we go into the text where we're going to see idolatry as an issue, we have something to think about here. What I'm concerned about is I know for myself that when I hear the word idolatry, especially as a younger Christian, what I tended to think of is, what's the problem with idolatry? Well, the problem with idolatry is if you're an idol worshiper, you have the wrong religion. You're supposed to worship God, Yahweh, and instead you're worshiping Baal or whoever the idol is. That's bad. God, see, you need to put the right deity at the head of your religion. And if you put the wrong deity at the head of your religion, then you have the wrong religion. Our religion has this God as a God. Their religion has that God as a God. So that's bad. And furthermore, idols are statues, and you look at the statue and you think, this represents my God. And the other thing that's wrong about it is that idea somehow that God would be this little idol there. Who could be stupid enough to think that chunk of wood is a God? That's what's wrong with idolatry, is you have the wrong religion and you're stupid enough to think that a statue is real. Well, no. I don't think that's at the heart of the problem with idolatry, although those things enter into it. We as human beings have this big problem. Ever since we got kicked out of the garden, life has been like this. We live with the experience of the world around us and no direct experience with the Creator. God, the source of all life, the Creator, the one who is all goodness, the source of all that is meaningful and real, is invisible to us and intangible. To live right, to actually be congruent with reality, I have to trust, love, follow, remember, believe in, obey, learn from someone that I cannot see. And in fact, if I understand who he is, there's a reason I can't see him. He is beyond me. He's not one of the things in my world. He is above my world. He created my world. My world could disappear, but he couldn't. That's the sort of God that we have to come to terms with. But does God seem to me as the most real thing, the one who is responsible for everything else? No. This stuff seems like the most real stuff. And God, at best, is someone that I sort of, a phantom that I try to convince myself is out there somewhere. He seems like he's the least real of all of the things that I encounter, when in fact, he is the most real of everything that is. So it is so tempting for us to replace God, the intangible and invisible, with stuff in this world, to think that somehow this is the stuff that's important. I have real problems in the real world that I want solved. I want to find whoever can solve my problem now. If I have a religion, I want a religion that is practical, that is going to do for me what I need done now. I want gods who will send the rains, make me fertile, give me wealth and happiness. I want what I want because I live in a world that is impinging on me, really. I have desires right now that are very real to me, and God is very distant compared to those desires and those pressures. So, and I make statues of idols, if I do, as a human being, because I don't have a picture of God as that one who is not a part of this creation. I have a picture. I want a God who's tangible. I want one that I can look at and say, yeah, there he is. I may be sophisticated enough to realize that the God is back beyond the statue. He's not just the statue here, but this statue is tangible. This statue is kind of like me. I can represent him as a person or an animal and say, yeah, I understand this God. He's like that animal. He's like that person. I know what I need to do to convince him to be on my side. And so Idolatry, as I understand it, is just a particular flavor of worldliness. I think that this world is what it's about, and what I understand about things in this world is what it's about. I want a God I can see, one that I can manipulate with religion, one that solves the problems that I have in the world. Because I know that the most important things are the things that I see around me right now. Well, the very heart of our faith, to believe in Jesus, to become a Christian in a meaningful sense, is to turn that around, is to look at that and say, I have been wrong. The fact is that God is the most real thing. His salvation is the thing most to be desired. Nothing in this world can solve my problem. Nothing in this world is important as that which God desires, as that which God has promised, that which is reflected in His character, and so on. That's what I have agreed to when I'm saying Jesus is Lord. I'm saying that the world is an entirely different place than I have been accustomed to think of it. And to live as a believer, then, is to face the implications of that. I am not in this by myself. This stuff here is not the most important stuff. There is something else. I can't see it, but I understand it, and I know it, and I want it, and that's what my life is about. So idolatry, in that sense, then, is the very opposite of what we're being called to in our faith. It is that idea that somehow this stuff here is going to pay off for me, as opposed to the transcendent Creator in whom I put my trust and embrace His promises. That's what is going to pay off for me in the end. Okay, having said all of that, let's look at 1 Corinthians 10. For I do not want you to be unaware, brethren, that our fathers were all under the cloud, and all passed through the sea, and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, and all ate the same spiritual food, and all drank the same spiritual drink, for they were drinking from a spiritual accompanying rock, and the rock was Christ. Okay, I do not want you to be aware, brethren, for I do not want you to be unaware, brethren. This follows right after what Paul said in the last chapter, where he's talking about how he himself wants to make sure that he is not disqualified. He has to himself embrace the gospel that he preaches. After preaching to others, I don't want to be disqualified myself. So he's going to go on with that theme. The theme that he wants to explore is the idea that someone could be involved in the religion and yet not really themselves be partaking of it. That you could be doing it, but not really believing it, not really having invested your own life in it. And he's going to look at the example of the Israelites as an example of what that might look like. Okay. Now, he says, he has this list of things. He says, our fathers were all under the cloud. That is, we're talking about that first generation of Jews that came to know Yahweh through Moses and the law. These are the ones that Moses went to, proclaimed Yahweh's message, gave them the law, and so on. These are the fathers, as he's calling them. They were under the cloud. That is, they experienced the miracle of the presence of God in the cloud that led them through the wilderness. There was this cloud that was their guide, which represented the presence of God. And they followed it, and it came down into the temple and various things. But part of his emphasis here is all of them were under the cloud. The whole nation as a group, all of them were led by the cloud. And they all passed through the sea. That is, there was the miracle of the parting of the Red Sea so that the nation could escape from the armies of Pharaoh that were chasing them. So this incredible miracle of the waters parting so that the nation could be rescued from their enemies. And again, the emphasis is all of them passed through the Red Sea. So that entire generation of Israelites were led by the cloud. They all went through the Red Sea. It wasn't just the good guys, ultimately, who went through the Red Sea. They all did. It wasn't just the good guys who were led by the cloud. They were all led by the cloud. And then he uses this strange language. All were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. And I think what he's getting at here, it's possible, it's not essential, I think, that the sea and the cloud have water involved with them. I think that may have helped to inspire this picture that he wants to give. I don't think it's necessarily essential. Because the idea of being baptized into here in this case, I mean, you have to remember, literally speaking, they didn't get wet. It's not like the cloud was drenching them and they were all wet when they went through the sea. The whole point was they didn't get wet when they went through the sea. So they weren't baptized in that sense. But the idea is baptism as initiation. Baptism as I have to be baptized into Moses meant that this was the group. They heard Moses, they listened to his message, they followed him into the wilderness. This was the group of people who were Moses' people, who were God's people, really. These are the ones to whom God had said, I have promises for you, I made promises to Abraham, and you are Abraham's children, and I am calling you out to a promised land. So, by going through the Red Sea, following Moses through the Red Sea, and by following the cloud in the wilderness, they became Moses' people. They were baptized into Moses in the sense that they became that group that was identified. Who is it that has received promises? Them. Who is it that God has promised the promised land? Them. They're the ones. They're the group that belonged to Moses and the law that Moses gave and the promises that Moses gave and so on. And again, the emphasis is they all were. Every single one of them was baptized into Moses in that sense. They all belonged to this group of Moses' people. And all ate the same spiritual food. He's talking about the manna primarily and probably the quails that God sent and so on. I think by spiritual in this case, it's a little tough, but right now I would understand him to mean basically supernatural. That is, you remember what's striking about the manna is this was something that was unexpected, something that came sent from God. The quails were sent from God. The manna was so much in God's control that there was one day that it didn't come and they had to gather twice as much the day before and that kind of stuff. So I take that back. I just made that up off the spur of my top of my head, and sometimes the top of my head has stuff you shouldn't repeat. So I take that back. Because it did come on that day, didn't it? No, I didn't, because they went out to gather it. I was saying, how did they violate it? They went out to gather it. It's not that they gathered it, but they went out looking for it, and it wasn't there. So that's right, I was right. See, top of my head's okay. All right, so. Okay, so I think what he means by spiritual food is this is not ordinary food. This is food provided by God. This is supernatural food that God provided as a part of his promise to take care of them. This was God's provision for them, his spirit providing what they needed here. I think that's what he means by spiritual food. And again, it was supernatural. It was an intervention on their behalf by God, and all of them partook of it. Everyone ate the manna. And all drank the same spiritual drink, for they were drinking from a spiritual accompanying rock, and the rock was Christ. I don't need to talk about this verse. It's clear enough what it means, I think. We'll move on to the next one. Okay, well, part of it is clear enough. When he's talking about the same spiritual drink, now we're talking about, I think, two in particular events that are very similar. In both cases, one of them is before they arrive at the promised land, and the other is later, much later, after they have been sent back into the wilderness because of their unbelief, and they wander for 40 years in the wilderness. But essentially, in both cases, the situation is the same. They end up in a situation where there isn't any water around, and the people start complaining. There's no water. Why'd you bring us here? We're going to die. And God, in both of these cases, splits a rock and water comes out and they are rescued from their thirst that they were afraid of. The second time is the one where it's a little unclear. I won't go into it now, but this is the one where Moses doesn't do it right. And God tells him that he can't go into the promised land. And there's some debate as to what it is that Moses did that God was upset with. And we could talk about that if you want. But the idea is that there are these two events where a rock was split so that water might come to them. Now, so it's spiritual drink in the same sense that the manna was spiritual food. And again, the emphasis is they all drank this. Every one of them experienced these two miracles where the water came forward for them. Now, the tricky part, I'm not entirely convinced that I understand what's happening with this yet, but here's what I would say right now. This idea of the spiritual accompanying rock. I don't think that Paul is saying that Jesus transformed himself into a rock and rolled around behind them as they were going through the wilderness. This doesn't make any sense. There's no reason to think that that's true, I don't think. I don't think that he's necessarily even implying that it was the same rock each time. The translation, New American Standard, the rock that followed them sort of implies that there was this rock that was rolling along with them or something. I think the language is derived from the fact that we have these two nearly identical stories, one here and one here. They're not in the same location. They're not in the same place in the region, and yet each time they grumbled and the rock brought forth water. So I'm not sure what that word that we could translate accompanying or following or something like that. I think, as best I could put it together right now, Paul is just alluding to the fact that in each case we have this rock. So with them on these occasions was this rock from which the water came forward. So in essence, this is a story about a rock that gives water. Okay, technically speaking, it was a different rock each time, but that's not essential. The key here is that these very similar events happen where a rock gives forth water. And then when he says the rock was Christ, I'm open for suggestions as to how to put that together. I thought about it a while and various things flipped through your mind. What makes the most sense to me at this point is that he means to suggest that analogically, if kind of in terms of we think about types, that is, back then, here we have a rock from which sustaining drink has come forward to sustain the people. Well, that's what Christ is to us. So what he's saying is that the analogy to us, what is Christ? That rock was to them what Christ is to us. The rock from which we receive the drink that gives us life. So, if anyone wants to make a different case, I'm open to it, but that's what would make sense to me right now. Now, the trickiest part of this, I think what he's doing here is that if we were to talk about how Christ provides this drink that gives life, I'm inclined to think that Paul has in mind here what we think of as the communion, as the Eucharist, as what Jesus talked about as his body being true food and his blood being true drink. Now, why do I say that? That might seem like a surprising direction for me to go because I tend to go in non-ritual, non-religious ways of understanding what biblical authors are saying. So why did you do that here, Ron? Why not just take it as an analogy? It's just the water of life, you know, and that's as far as it goes. Well, I think the reason I'm inclined to take it that way is because I think what Paul is doing is making an analogy. This language that he used, Israel was baptized into Moses and they got this spiritual food and spiritual drink. I think the analogy he wants to make is the Corinthians have become Christians and they have partaken of the things that identify them with the Christians. So they have been baptized into Jesus and they have partaken of the spiritual food and the spiritual drink. That is, they participate in the communion that the rest of the Christians participate in. So in other words, what he's picturing is they have outwardly involved themselves with the things of the Christians just as the Israelites outwardly involved themselves with the things of Moses. They followed Moses. They all experienced these miracles together. They all drank this drink from God. They all ate this food from God. And the analogy he wants to make, I think, is that you guys are in the same spot. You have been baptized into Jesus, and you eat the food, and you drink the drink. But so what? Is the question that's going to come up. What does that mean in the end? Because, as we see for the Israelites, nevertheless, with most of them, God was not well pleased, for they were laid low in the wilderness. Now these things happened as examples for us, that we should not crave evil things as they also craved. And do not be idolaters as some of them were, as it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and stood up to play. Nor let us act immorally as some of them did, and 23,000 fell in one day. Nor let us put the Lord to the test as some of them did and were destroyed by the serpents. Nor grumble as some of them did and were destroyed by the destroyer. Okay. So I want to take a minute to talk about these little examples here. With most of them, God was not well pleased, for they were laid low in the wilderness. This is the key to the point he wants to make. What he's been saying is, I don't want you to be unaware. Don't forget that Israel was this group. Everyone was involved. Everyone followed Moses. Everyone went through the Red Sea. Everyone followed the cloud. Everyone ate the manna. Everyone drank the water, the drink from the rock that God did. So God was doing all of this great stuff, and they all participated in it. But does that mean that these were the people with whom God was pleased? Is that why they got all this stuff? No, it's not. Because as we look at the story, in fact, God was not pleased with most of them. Most of the people who went through the Red Sea and followed the cloud and ate the manna and drank the water from the rock were ultimately condemned by God. Now, the point here is that God had committed himself to the Israelites as a nation. He had made promises to them as a nation, but each individual still stood or fell before God based on their own choice of whether they were going to follow God and trust him and believe in him or turn away from him. Each of them still faced that question. And the first generation in the wilderness, most of them made that choice against God. Now, in a minute we'll see why I would say this, but let me be clear. There are those who would want to see this picture as God was disciplining them. These were his people, they were believers, and we'll see them in heaven someday, but he was just demonstrating that you can't mess around with God, so he did wipe them out, but you know, then he took them into heaven and said, okay, that wasn't so bad, was it? Now, I don't think there's any reason to think that that's the case. These were not believers. That's the whole point of these stories, is that although they identified with the people, they were rebels against God in reality. And that's what you have to see in the story. I mean, if we want to say that the first generation of Israelites in the wilderness were believers, then we have to get a pretty strange picture of what it means to be a believer. And that's what Paul's going to spell out here. Okay, now these things happened as examples for us, that we should not crave evil things as they also craved. And this is important to Paul. Is this story, what happened to Israel, is at least in part meant to be an object lesson to the people of God. For those who have eyes to see and ears to hear, this story of what happened to Israel is very significant, and we're supposed to learn from it. And I've always thought that that's a very important thing. This is a little bit of a side issue, but it's easy for us as Christians, especially in our history, to think, you get the picture, okay, the Old Testament is bad. That's the stuff that the New Testament came along to replace. The Old Testament is bad because it's Jewish. It's got all these Jews in it, and they do all this old, like circumcision and eating kosher and all these stupid things, and they were bad people. Jews are bad. What makes the New Testament is we come along now and now we're dealing with Gentiles. Gentiles are good, Jews are bad. Now nobody would exactly say that, maybe some people would. But we kind of get that picture that somehow the Jews are the ones who screwed up and the Gentiles are the ones who come along and get to be Christians. That's the picture that we get. But that's not it. I mean, what was happening, I always think it's helpful to remember, what was happening while Israel was following around the cloud in the wilderness? I mean, were the pagan nations around them this model of godliness? No, I mean, we were worse. The Gentiles were worse than what the Jews were. The key is that the Jews are representative of humanity. God took a particular group. It could have been any group. He could have done it with the Irish. And it would have turned out the same. I mean, I have a lot of Irish in my background. The Irish could be the chosen people. And I could be a member of the chosen nation. But what would have happened if the Irish had been led through the wilderness and done all this? That they would have done the same thing. Because that's the kind of people we are. This is an example for all of us. This is what happens apart from the grace of God giving me the eyes to see so that I can turn away from my own rebellion against God. This is what it looks like. That's what the example is. Here's the example of this is the choice you face. This is how bad it can get. Okay. So, he says that they should not crave evil things. I'm not sure if he has something particular in mind here. He may just be setting up. The next four examples are much more specific. And so he may just be setting up the next four. I'm not sure. The first specific example he gives is, do not be idolaters, as some of them were. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and stood up to play. This is from the famous story of the golden calf. God has led them out into the wilderness. He takes Moses up to the mountain to show him his law. Moses is a little while in coming back. The people decide, we're going to take this into our own hands. And they make a molten calf. And they said, this is your God, O Israel, who brought you up from the land of Egypt. Now when Aaron saw this, he built an altar before it. And Aaron made a proclamation and said, tomorrow shall be a feast to the Lord. So the next day they rose early and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings. And the people sat down to eat and to drink and rose up to play. So that's where the verse comes from. The idea is, I mean, this is just kind of the picture of the idolatrous heart. Here we are out here. Moses isn't here. Moses is the guy who's been insisting that Yahweh is behind all this stuff. I don't know in this story that it's necessarily the case that the people are saying, Yahweh isn't God, we want a different one. It may be, but notice what they say. This is your God, O Israel, who brought you up from the land of Egypt. What they want is to take the God that they follow and make him tangible. Someone that we can look at and understand something about what he's like. It's like something that we know in this world. That's going to make us feel more comfortable. That, okay, yeah, this God here is the one that's taking care of us. And of course, you'll recall that God was not particularly happy with this, and things did not work out well for them because of doing this. When he says stood up to play, I'm aware of two different ways of understanding this. Some people understand it to be sort of dancing, kind of pagan revelry sort of thing, and others understand it to be a euphemism for sexual immorality. And if you remember the movie The Ten Commandments, you remember that Cecil B. DeMille decided to play it safe and get both of those in. So, in fact, he wanted to play it really safe, and he got quite a bit of that in. You always have to be a little leery about those movies that say, you want to see how bad sin is? This is really bad, huh? In fact, you haven't seen enough of this yet, have you? Because you want to see how bad this really is. So, like, look at what they're doing over there. Doesn't that, that's bad. Oh, that's a bad thing. Let's show you some more of that, because that's really bad. Well, Cecil B. DeMille understood what people wanted to see. Okay, so, nor let us act immorally, as some of them did, and 23,000 fell in one day. Okay, I believe this is referring to an incident While Israel remained at Shittim, the people began to play the harlot with the daughters of Moab, for they invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods. So Israel joined themselves to Baal of Peor, and the Lord was angry against Israel. And the Lord said to Moses, "Take all the leaders of the people and execute them in broad daylight before the Lord, so that the fierce anger of the Lord may turn away from Israel." So yes, there is sexual immorality involved here, but it is in the setting of joining themselves to the cultic practices of the Baal worshippers. So it's not just sexual immorality, it's sexual immorality in the context of idolatry. "Nor let us put the Lord to the test, as some of them did, and were destroyed by the serpents." This is the famous story of the bronze serpent. They set out from Mount Hor by the way of the Red Sea to go around the land of Edom. And the people became impatient because of the journey. And the people spoke against God and Moses, "Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness?" Here they are again. This is a very common theme in the story of Israel in the wilderness. Them complaining, "Why are you doing this to us? Look, we're going to die. There is no food and no water, and we loathe this miserable food." And the Lord sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people so that many people of Israel died. And then this is the scenario where the people come and say, "We have sinned," and Moses sets up the bronze serpent, and everyone who looks to the bronze serpent lives. What's interesting is that Paul uses the language here, "they put the Lord to the test." And this is a very important thing to understand, the concept of putting the Lord to the test in the story of Israel. What did they do in the story? They spoke against God and Moses. "Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness?" This is immediately after this great victory that God brings about for them, where they look to him for victory, he promises victory, the victory comes about, and now, after that, they're in a spot where it's not immediately apparent to them how they're going to take care of themselves, and they're complaining to God. And basically, what putting God to the test means is insisting that because things are not the way I want them right now, God has to prove himself to me all over again. God, in essence, I'm putting you to the test by saying, I have a right to be dismissive of you. Look at where I am. If you want me to have anything to do with you again, you're going to have to solve this problem. Because there's no reason that I could reasonably be expected to trust and follow a God who would put me in a spot like this where there's no food around. That's the idea of putting God to the test, as I understand it. It is, okay, God has demonstrated his faithfulness. He has done great things, especially in the life of Israel. They have seen him miraculously intervene on their behalf over and over again. And yet every time things get tough, they don't say to themselves, "We're going to turn to God and pray to him because we know how faithful he has been to us along the way." They say, "Why did you do this? This is wrong. You're bad. We don't have to listen to you because you're bad, because things are bad here." That's the putting God to the test that they have done. I think it's the worst thing about the faithlessness of Israel, that never, when it got tough, did they actually remember how faithful God had been and trust him in that situation. And the last thing he mentions is, "Don't grumble as some of them did and were destroyed by the destroyer." I believe what he's referring to, there are several events that could be, and maybe he has all of them in mind, I don't know, but a key event that he could be talking about where they're specifically described as grumbling, besides some of the ones we've seen, is when they entered into the land the first time, or were on the border of the land. They were ready to go into the land of Canaan, and they sent in the spies. And the spies come back and they tell them, "Well, this is bad. You know, they have big walls and big people, and we don't want to go in there." And Joshua and Caleb were the only two of the spies who said, "No, God has promised. Let's go in. We will prevail because God has promised that that's what will happen." So But the rest of the people listened to what the spies had said. Then all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept that night. And all of the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron. And the whole congregation said to them, "Would that we had died in the land of Egypt, or would that we had died in this wilderness. And why is the Lord bringing us into this land to fall by the sword? Our wives and our little ones will become plunder. Would it not be better for us to return to Egypt?" So they said to one another, "Let us appoint a leader and return to Egypt." And at this point, Joshua tries to persuade them, "No, no, God is faithful. We need to follow him. Listen to what he said." And their response is, then all the congregation said to stone them with stones. Basically, they wanted to stone Moses and Aaron and Joshua and anybody who's saying we ought to go in there. We'll appoint a new leader and we'll go back to Egypt. This is the culmination, in a way, of the faithlessness of Israel. And then the response is, "Then the glory of the Lord appeared in the tent of meeting to all the sons of Israel. And the Lord said to Moses, 'How long will this people spurn me? And how long will they not believe in me, despite all the signs which I have performed in their midst?'" And there's some complications here. And then he says, "Surely all the men who have seen my glory and my signs, which I performed in Egypt and in the wilderness, yet have put me to the test these 10 times and have not listened to my voice, shall by no means see the land which I swore to their fathers." And he says that their corpses will be scattered throughout the wilderness. So in this final sort of, let's kill Moses and go back to Egypt response to God's promise that they will prevail if they go into the land, God reminds them of the 10 times that they put him to the test, which means basically 10 times that when it got tough, they refused to trust God and complained and had no thought at all that God would keep his promises. The result was that entire generation, except for Caleb and Joshua, they didn't go into the land. Okay. "Now these things happened to them as an example, and they were written for our instruction, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. Therefore let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall." So, what we see here, he's saying again, this was an example for us. They were written for our instruction, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. We are in that last phase of this part of history, where Jesus has entered into the world, has made his salvation known, God's purposes have been clear. Paul sometimes refers to us as living in the last times, all from the time of Jesus until now, the last times, because this is it. This is that last opportunity. We see clearly what God has been doing, and we have the opportunity to involve ourselves in it or not. So this is the culmination of history, in that we have the opportunity to make that choice in the clearest possible way that the Israelites were making in a less clear way. They didn't see all that was at stake. We see much more clearly what is at stake. We're in the ends of the age. But in essence, the decision they faced is the same one that we face now. "Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall." And this is Paul's very sober warning to the Corinthians. Remember the situation. He's talking to people who are blasé about idolatry. He is talking about people who in many ways have demonstrated their worldliness and lack of interest in the things of God. And he's warning them, just because you belong to the group doesn't mean that you yourself have actually tasted of the fruit of this stuff. You have to decide, is this true? You have to decide, do I want this? You have to decide, what is my life going to be about? And you who are cocky in particular, you who have this idea, hey, I know I have freedom, I have the right theology, you guys are screwed up, I know that it's okay to do this. You who are so confident that you've got it all together, you in particular had better stop and ask yourself, where am I in this? It's the one who thinks that he's got it all together that is in most danger of falling. That is because he has forgotten the problem. He has forgotten his problem and he has forgotten who God is. You can't understand how serious your situation is in life and be cocky about it. There is a God who holds your destiny in his hands, and it's all about whether you are going to decide to repent of the great evil of your life and turn to him for life. This is serious stuff. Okay. In conclusion, it seems to me then, this is very sobering, this is very serious, serious stuff that Paul is saying here. I mean, this has got to get, if it's anything like what I'm saying it is, this has got to get your attention. I mean, this is your life you're holding in your hands, he's saying. I think there are two equally wrong ways of understanding what Paul is getting at here. I want to emphasize what I think he is saying. One wrong way would be to take that approach. Salvation is not at stake. It was not at stake for the Israelites. They were just being disciplined. And Paul is not implying that salvation is at stake for the Corinthians. They believe in Jesus, so of course they're going to be saved. But he's warning them, take heed lest you fall. And by falling, you would disobey God and you would forfeit some of the privileges of being a Christian. You might, instead of having a good life, comfortable life now, you might end up suffering. You might even end up dying. You know, God would judge you and discipline you by bringing difficult things into your life. Of course, we're not talking about salvation because you believe in Jesus and everybody knows if you believe in Jesus, then you're saved. That is not what Paul is doing here. His whole point, if you look at the Israelites were the classic example of what it looks like to, in theory, be committed to be followers of God, and yet, in fact, their entire way of living was one of unbelief. They did not believe the promises that God made. He demonstrated powerfully how capable he was of keeping his promises and how committed he was to them, but they didn't believe it. When push came to shove, they never, ever believed it. So, Paul's warning is, being in the group is not going to do it for you. You have to make that decision to actually embrace this thing for yourself. Particularly, the blasé attitude of the Corinthians towards idolatry in this situation is very worrying to Paul. How come you're taking this so lightly? This is a huge deal. Look at the place that idolatry played in the role of the Israelites. They died. They were cut off from the people. They were condemned because of it. How can you take it so lightly? There is only one thing to do with God. You can't toy with him. You can't take him lightly. You can repent and trust him and follow him. Or not. That's the choice that you've got. On the other hand, the other wrong way of thinking about what Paul's saying here is that this passage demonstrates that you can lose your salvation. At any moment, you could screw up and you were great, things were going fine, but you messed up and now you're out. That's not what Paul is suggesting here either, because the picture that he's painting is not one of genuine belief that turns into unbelief. He's talking about the picture that he's painting is the nation being identified with the people of God and Moses' stuff, but never actually submitting themselves to it, never actually believing it and embracing it. So if we were to try to figure out what picture is Paul painting here, it's the picture of the nominal sort of commitment to a religious way of life for whatever reasons I might have, but not actually having recognized my need for forgiveness and having turned to God for life. That's the kind of scenario he's painting. If we were to look at Paul's theology as we see it expressed in other places in his letters, we would come to see that in fact, he believes that my faith can be tried and that I can actually come to see the reality that I am a believer. Because if situations have shown that there's some meat to this, that this actually means something to me, then I am one of those people in whom the grace of God is at work. So it's not, the message isn't, it doesn't matter what you've done till now, you could screw it up at any minute. The message is, you need to make sure that this is real to you and that you're not just playing games here. But if I have come to, by the grace of God, see that in fact there is some reality to this in my own life, then that becomes a basis from which having some confidence that God is actually at work in me. And in that sense, it is not true that I can lose my salvation in the sense that God's happy with me, I'm going to be saved. Oh, it's too bad I didn't die today because I screwed up and now I'm not. That's not the picture. And it all depends on our making this distinction between, on the one hand, sin is a reality in human life. But we're not just talking about sin. What we're talking about is belief or unbelief. Submitting to the truth about who I am and who God is and what I need or not. The Israelites never submitted. They never saw God as He was, even close. They never believed in His power and in His goodness for them, even though they saw it demonstrated. The issue we face as believers is, am I going to believe this? Am I going to hold to it? Am I going to see it as true and see it as the solution to the problem of my own life? That's the issue. So what Paul is urging the Corinthians to do is, look, you know, I'm really troubled by the fact that you guys are so hip about this idolatry stuff. You're trying to get the other guys to come along with you and, hey, it's no big deal. We have the freedom. You know, hey, let's go over to the temple and eat over at the dining room. That used to be fun. You know, I mean, what are you thinking? What do you value? What do you think is true? Who is God in the end? That's what Paul's concerned about. And so for us, as we to take away from this, that's what we need to be concerned about. Not that every sin that I come across in my own life demonstrates I'm not a believer, because none of us here are believers, if that's true. And I am certainly not. But I think I am a believer. And the reason I think that is because I have seen God at work in my life, not to rescue me totally from sin, but to open my eyes to the fact that I am a sinner and that I need Him and that I want Him. And that's what I want ultimately in my life. That's what Paul is asking us to do. Make sure that you understand what's at stake in this stuff and choose for life. Don't toy with this thing. Okay, well, I'm a bad person because last week I said I was going to leave plenty of time for questions and I didn't. Is there like any real pressing question that you would like to ask? I could maybe, it's not, we're already over, but I could take like maybe one or two like really quickly if you would like. Otherwise I'll just be up here. That was a big welcoming invitation, wasn't it? Are you really going to bother us all with your questions? No. Go ahead, Margaret, go ahead. I meant it. I'm inviting a question.
This was a question that came up in the first part of your talk, and as your talk evolved, I thought, I'm not going to ask this question because it's stupid compared to what you were just talking about, but as long as you've asked... I wasn't here last week, so you may have talked about this last week. I was interested, whenever you're dealing with somebody who says you shouldn't be doing that and you feel the freedom to do something, one possibility is that these are immature believers, weaker brothers, people who don't have good understanding but their heart is really with God. Another possibility is that they're hypocrites and... Pharisees and that kind of thing. And I know I've heard teaching before and thought that this was true, that how you behave partly depends upon where you perceive the person to be coming from. Right. If the person is really the weaker brother and it's truly their conscience which is screaming, you do not dare suggest that they violate their conscience. If this person is a Pharisee, you might want to get in their face and say...
Right.
So there.
Right.
So that, I know we probably don't have time to cover that huge topic, but if you have something to say about that or if you talked about it last week, I'll get the tape.
No, Last week I talked about that quite a bit, I think. That has been a big theme in the last several weeks, somewhere along the line here. I'm not exactly sure where. But yes, absolutely. That's why I was saying you have to understand what the scenario is, what Paul is arguing against. And basically, the question is, I want to act loving for the other person. What impact am I having on them? The scenario he's talking about is, I'm dealing with someone who I genuinely understand to be weak in the sense that they have a misunderstanding of what it is that God is asking them to do. I want to encourage them to follow God and do what is right. And I do not want to communicate to them that I don't care about what is right. And I don't, or encourage them to do otherwise. At the same time, though, we have the model of the way Paul dealt with the issue of circumcision, which was very similar with Titus and that stuff. And there he's saying, we did not submit to them for an hour. Because the issue is different. Yeah, they're offended, and they think it's wrong, but the issue is, how do you find salvation? Who is it that God accepts and does not accept? And that they were basically legalists in the disguise of believers. And it is not loving to reinforce legalism. So yes, I have to decide the best I can what's at stake here in order to decide where in one case I might absolutely say, no way, I'm not giving in at all. And in another case I say, yeah, I'm just going to go along with that. Both times it's for their sake. The question I'm trying to assess is, what is good for them, as best as I can understand it?
I liked your analogy a lot with the R-rated movies thing. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to understand the analog, and I wonder if you've thought this through further than I can go here. I understand the attraction of... I understand where the real immorality, the real perversion that's attractive to us is in R-rated movies. Eating meat offered to idols doesn't titillate me.
Uh-huh.
I don't think.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So
right.
It's hard to know why... What would be the real immorality? What would be the real evil that Paul suspects might be underneath that is motivating them and driving them? Have you identified something?
Yeah, well, I don't. I know just what you're talking about, Jack, and I have wrestled with that question too. I think there are several possibilities. I think at least it is that not taking God seriously. That there is something about the scenario, maybe if it does include going to the temple dining rooms, you know, which as we go on here, it seems as if it may involve that, because there's something that Paul's telling them to stay away from, that there may be a certain, you know, the community kind of sees me as not being one of those hung up Christians, but I'm kind of, you know, I'm with you with this stuff, sure, I'll come and eat the meat there. So the attraction is the community sees me and I see myself as being
tolerant
and open-minded.
And
not just that, but I'm sophisticated. I understand. I have wisdom, maybe, you know, that kind of stuff. That seems to me to be a likely possibility. There is the question as to whether, because Paul emphasizes the sexual immorality at times in the examples that he gives here from Israel. I don't know. You know, earlier he was talking about going to the prostitutes and warning them against doing that. And there seems to be historical debate whether there was temple prostitution going on in Corinth at this time. Some say no, some say yes. I don't know whether there's some other stuff involved with it that they're kind of opening the door to just sort of going back and being involved with things that were there. I agree. It's a little bit difficult to say. The first one makes the most sense to me. But
yeah. If it is a lust for intellectual and cultural respectability, I mean, that's pretty profound then. I mean, right. In terms of the implications for us today, because I see that in a lot of ways, how much we are willing to compromise in order to not seem out of it culturally.
Right. Yeah, no, absolutely. But it is a tricky question. We will skip next week, and 2 weeks from now we'll pick it up.